to see some serious shit.
This is about to go off.
It's the movie podcast that comes to you in video and audio, now in its seventh great year, Movie Mode, a ThinkMcFlyThink.com production. Starring film nerd and self-hating ex-geek, Jamie Williams. And me, Phil G, British gentleman agent at your service. Also starring Captain Ed Hocken as Captain Ed Hocken. And many more. Coming up tonight, film critic Gabe Torra returns to the show to discuss The Last Stand and Broken City. The death of HMV in the UK turns old granddads into thieves. And 32 years late, we finally review Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to your weekly Movie Moan. And it's an occasion of great sadness for me, and also great joy. It's a great sadness because, as many of you may have heard, if you get your news from the BBC anyway, that we have lost the last bastions of physical media stores in this country this week. We lost HMV at the start of the week, and we lost Blockbuster in the middle of the week. Technically, they're not lost, but we'll get into the details of that. But still, it's very, 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 very sad times here. And we're going to talk about that a bit, because I kind of, if you're a long-time listener of the show, I kind of prophesied this. And of course, in typical fashion, now that it's actually happened, I wish I could take it all back. But we'll get to that. But it is a time of great joy because, back by popular demand, I know you guys loved him when he was on here a couple of weeks ago. I know you wanted him back. Just by coincidence, he is back. It feels like, you know, we've just barged into his room and we're recording and he's just sitting here and he just letting us get on with it. But he is here. Will you please welcome Mr. Gabe Torra, film critic for The Playlist and Jump Cut Junkies. Hello, sir.
Hey. How y'all doing, everyone?
That was like, hey, get out my room. That was a kind of aggressive hey. Yeah, I was a bit worried there.
Hold on, let me just put my pants on. Okay, how you all doing, everyone?
And he's off. Also joining us tonight, I'm sure he's down with that, film there, Jamie Williams. Hello, sir.
Hi, kids, how are you?
We're good. Well, we're sad. We'll get to it. And also, I mean, I don't know if he's with us. He's with us in spirit. I think he's watching some videos right now. Captain Ed Hocken, what are you watching, sir?
Well, no, Phil, I that video I was watching was only a minute long, and that was from the movie that we'll never see, that's currently making the rounds, is called Escape from Tomorrowland. This is, as you know, Sundance is currently going on. I firmly believe, as many others have said, Escape from Tomorrowland will be one of those movies that you'll hear about, but will never get released.
We need a White Dog for our generation. I think this is it, guys.
No. This is rather, because White Dog finally got released on Criterion some time ago. This is more of the, my personal, what I think is more infamous, is Todd Haynes' debut movie, The Karen Carpenter Story. If you've ever heard of this, it also, I think if the entire movie or at least part of the movie, is, you know, where Barbie dolls are used to explain what's going on. That to me is one of the classic unreleasable movies.
Well, I mean, the king of them all, of course, is The Day the Clown Cried. Which,
well, The Day the Clown Cried.
Which Ed and I, to be fair, like, for you kids out there listening, Ed and I maintain that the moment Jerry Lee Lewis dies,
Curtis got to do with this?
Yeah, excuse me, Jerry Lewis, excuse me, thank you. The moment he croaks, I think his estate or his kids are going to finally just release
the
damn movie.
The Day the Clown Cried will, as you just said, will get released, and it's not being held up for any legal reason. Well, actually, there are,
I think he's got some kind of arrangement so that when he's dead, they'll release it.
So, still very fascinating, especially in this day and age. For those of you that don't know, this movie is basically where some guy went around. He shot an entire movie on the grounds of Disney World, where the story takes place. Where it's about a father who finds out he loses his job on the last day of his family vacation at Disney World, and there is this unauthorized use of Disney imagery, grounds, characters, rides, everything is in the movie. It's not disguised. It's all over the place. So, as you can already tell, for those of you armchair legal scholars out there, this is not going to get released. And if it did, that would be a miracle, quite honestly. I don't, especially when we're talking about Disney here, there's just no way in hell that's going to happen. So, just by sheer coincidence, I happen to know someone who is going to Sundance right now. I'll definitely be chatting with him because he's planning on checking this movie out. I know, speaking of possibly very ponderous and almost impenetrable film, I know, Phil, you had just happened to see a classic, or at least deemed by some, by the so-called critics of Europe.
That. No, stop with that bullshit again! I hate
that! No. I've always stated I'd never liked the phrase, well, the critics in Europe like it. Well, who were these critics, and what did they have to actually say about it? Because saying that the critics in Europe liked it is like saying it's big in Japan, or you got to hear the notes that are not being played. It's a phrase that you can't say if you want to be taken seriously, you know.
Well, as much as I'd love to leap on that beautiful segue, Captain, you know, Gabe is our guest, and I have
asked
him to do his piece first. So, Gabe, unfortunately, well, of course, I live in the UK, a Philistine country that doesn't get new releases, and these guys are obviously busy with other things, but you saw the new releases this week, so please start us off, if you will, with the return of Mr. Schwarzenegger in The Last Stand.
Yeah, The Last Stand. Yeah, this movie, I was looking forward to this picture because it was the debut of
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I tried to Google him, and I got like 20 different results of different people.
You mean the director of G. Woon Kim?
Yes, thank you. He directed
Miami Connection.
I saw The Devil. He directed The Bittersweet Life. He directed The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. So he clearly is interested in dabbling in different genres and kind of giving a new spin to them. I saw The Devil. I thought it was particularly interesting like that, in that it was a horror film that felt like it was made like an action film, like it was a slasher suspense thriller with action elements, action beats almost, you know. I thought it was really unique in that aspect, so I thought he'd kind of bring kind of an interesting spin to The Last Stand, but which by the way, spoiler alert, the title is meaningless. It's just some dumb jerk off action movie. I was really disappointed. It really is like, it's a small town. It's like, but it's not a small town. It's a Hollywood small town with like you might as well have cast animatronics, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like a Disney World ride where they're just like, welcome to the coffee shop, you know. Old people, like, just, you know, looking off the fat land, crap like that. You know, it's all bullshit, and we're, like, the deputy's office is, like, five cops for the entire town. And, Schwarzenegger is the sheriff, and there's a drug kingpin who is also apparently a race car driver.
Mm-hmm.
And he's driving to the town in order to get to Mexico to get away, because it's one of those movies where, like, you know, this some guy is like a world famous, hugely awful criminal, but all he has to do is cross the border into Mexico, mm-hmm. and he's 100% safe. You know, that wonderful fantasy. I never understood that at all.
Please tell me Robert Darby's playing this part.
No, it's Eduardo Noriega, who is like supposed to be kind of the answer to Schwarzenegger, because Schwarzenegger's all withered and ancient and tough, and Noriega is like smooth and a ladies' man, and is a little effeminate, and that same bullshit, you know.
Yes.
And you know, I would have loved to see Schwarzenegger come back and like match up against someone like Ben Foster or something, like somebody really intense and scary, you know. But instead, it's like this, you know, I'm so smooth, I wear designer clothing sort of villain. So, you know, they get to the small town, there's big shootouts, and people are blowing up in, like, really comic ways. But it's weird because his other films as a director were very expansive. They were all-terrain ridiculous. They would go planes and trains and automobiles and on rooftops and on roads. And here it's just like, you know, there's a couple blocks of a studio backlot. And it feels like an Old West shoot-em-out show at, like, Universal Studios, where, like, the guy gets hit with a flare gun. He's wearing a bandolero, one of those things with, like, a bunch of bullets in it. What do they call those?
Got me.
Where they wear it across the chest?
It's a bandolero. It's a bandolero.
Bandolero? Yeah. It's like a guy gets shot with a flare gun while he's wearing a bandolero, so all the bullets go off and he explodes, that sort of thing.
Right.
You know? Like, you know, clever. Peter Stormare plays one of the villains who has a southern accent, I think.
Oh, that must be painful.
I have no idea. Like, I don't know if he was pretending or what his character's deal was, or if they just said cast him as a southerner. Or I really don't understand what was going on there. It was really kind of spectacular. But, you know, it's just like, it's a movie where everyone, all the characters, they run into a conflict, then they say, we're going to shoot it out between each other. And then at the end they say, now we're going to punch it out between each other, and that's it. I was really surprised at how, like, it's so dumb that I think it tries to transcend that, but I don't think it really works. I think it just stays at that dumb level, you know? There's one gag involving Johnny Knoxville. Johnny Knoxville is one of the guys. He's like the town retard or something. I really don't know what they were going for there. It's vaguely offensive. But he has this pratfall where he like falls on this guy's truck and hurts himself. And it's like done with like cutaways. And they cut away to another scene. And they cut back to him and he's falling and he hits his head or something like that. It was just the most mismanaged slapstick joke I'd seen in such a long time.
And now I have to ask, now Luis Guzman, who we all love here, I'm assuming we all love him, there's a bit in the trailer where he talks about a sword. Now, I'm assuming there's payoff. Is there payoff?
God damn it. I was just thinking about that too. No.
Oh.
He holds a sword. He holds a sword, and he has another medieval weapon that I can't recall. And he brandishes them. He's like, "Hey, you never know." And I guess you never do know because you never see him use them. So, I don't know what they were trying to go for.
It's got to be better than bullet to the head, though. That looks garbage.
It's better. Well, that's a Walter Hill movie. That's a Walter Hill movie. So let's slow our roll here until we see it. You know?
I know.
Let's slow our roll.
Exactly, guys. I mean, Walter Hill, Billions, man. Brilliant.
Hey, that was a for hire gig.
I know. But hey, you
go too far, Williams. You go too far.
I'm being rough on The Last Stand, but the fact is, it's probably better than Collateral Damage. And
wow. Probably
The Sixth Day. and Jingle All the Way. Basically anything he's done in the last decade.
That isn't Eraser. Okay.
As a star. It's not as good as Eraser.
Oh my god. I'm definitely not going there.
I'm just going to say that. I'm going to throw that out there. Regardless of what you thought of Eraser, it's not up to the standard of Eraser.
But with an 80% margin for
error. Well, that's what I think. When I watch any Schwarzenegger movie, I'm like, is it good, bad, or is it Eraser?
For me, Eraser is the cutoff point, you know, between watching it and not watching it. Like, oh, I really want to see that. And then Eraser is like, oh, it's on. So, you know, beyond that, you know, I turn away. I can't watch,
The Sixth Day?
The Sixth Day.
Yeah.
I can't watch anything
that's
like that.
That's my birthday cake! He's eating my cake!
No, someone in my house, and he's not me.
I'm you and you're me! So I'm gonna tell you to go fuck yourself!
It's so sad anyway. Seeing a guy like Michael Rooker
you know, we all make the jokes here, but I do want to see triplets just to see the biggest disaster on screen.
Oh!
It's just me.
Oh, do you guys want to know something that I found out this weekend?
Shoot.
I don't think this has ever been reported on, but I spoke to somebody at ILM, and I spoke to somebody who spoke to somebody at ILM. Forgive me, I don't really, you know, but... they were talking about these tests in the 1990s for a film. That there were doing these effects tests for this film. It was apparently called Toddlers.
Uh-huh.
Which has never been, no one's ever, you know, talked about or anything like that. But they did some effects tests, and apparently they had a script. And it was going to be given to, it was a comedy about toddlers that had, like, the heads of adults. I don't know what the story was, but they were going to attach major stars onto toddler bodies. And it was going to be given to John Carpenter.
Oh, God.
But, you know, this is how a lot of movies happen in Hollywood where, or rather, a lot of movies don't happen. Because they explore it, they think about it, they maybe do an effects test, and they decide not to do it. So they did an effects test, and this was supposed to be, and they didn't have the actors, but they had the actors involved, but they didn't do the test with them. But the actors involved were Schwarzenegger and Eddie Murphy. Apparently John Carpenter saw the tests, and the whole thing shut down right after that, because he said, I'm not going to do it. This is incredibly stupid.
Well,
yeah.
Not only that, that was a whole fake movie and funny people. Basically.
Yes.
Redo. Yes. Well, see, that's the thing about Funny People. I always maintain that those were real pitches that probably Apatow was involved with at some point because those all seemed real.
Absolutely. They had to have been.
Yeah. I mean, My Best Friend is a Robot, you know, Redo, Merman. There's a lot of them. There was one involving...
Well, what does it tell you when Adam Sandler thinks the project is a bad idea?
Well, he did one, Jack and Jill.
But he did that. I'm just saying what happens if you think, you know, when Adam Sandler turns down your idea.
It's not like, that he turned him down. It's probably just that he didn't have the time.
Exactly.
Adam Sandler took a lot. I mean...
Look, we don't know what he's doing after Grown Ups 2.
That's a world exclusive right there, by the way.
That's great.
Toddlers. John Carpenter's Toddlers.
The Criterion Edition.
Starring Schwarzenegger and Eddie Murphy. And that's why I was not surprised to hear Eddie Murphy being rumored for this triplets thing that they were going to do with Schwarzenegger and DeVito, a sequel to Twins.
Look at the movies Eddie Murphy has done. I mean, what was it, Meet Dave and...
Starship Dave, yes.
Yeah. Is that what it was called?
Either way, yeah.
Starship Dave.
I don't know if you wanted to talk any more about The Last Stand. I wanted to say a little bit about Broken City as well.
You go ahead. I'm just gonna kill myself.
Sure, go ahead. I actually, you know, Broken City is the type of movie that it comes out and then no one gives a shit and no one really talks about, and then maybe you watch on cable, but probably not. And you don't really remember the plot specifics. And, you know, that happens to a lot of movies, and I never really think that's fair. You know, because that should happen to, like, Big Daddy, but it doesn't. It always happens to something that, like, they wanted to be respectable, and it just didn't really work. So, I was watching Broken City, and I don't know if it was just I'd seen a lot of shitty movies recently or something like that, but I'm watching this and thinking, like, okay, the story is sort of interesting. The performances are pretty decent. There's a lot of very good actors in it. It's deadly serious. It's about adult things, you know. It's about adult issues. There are a couple action bits, but they're pretty short. You know, and it's very downbeat. And I'm thinking, like, you know, there's major things at stake. Okay, this is sort of interesting. And then I'm thinking, like, so why am I thinking about when's the next time I'm going to do laundry? Why am I thinking about picking up milk on the way home from the theater? Like, why are these things in my head? You know, it's just one of those movies. It just does not click at all. This was a Blacklist script. So it was really, it was kind of a big deal in the industry. And they gave it to Alan Hughes, one of the Hughes brothers, which, you know, I don't know. Together, they're not that much. So I don't know. When you cut that in half, I don't know what you get. they've never worked apart, I don't think. You know, and I hate saying that because they did Dead Presidents, which no one talks about, but it's a fucking amazing movie. Dead Presidents, it's really good.
Well, they've never lived up to that. It's the problem.
They never what? Sorry?
They've never lived up to that movie. I completely agree with you about that film, but, yeah. You know, it's like that was their first movie, if I remember correctly, and it's like you start off that good, and it's like, you know, what did they do next? They did From Hell.
No, their first movie was Menace to Society, and then they got some money, and they did Dead Presidents. And Dead Presidents was the thing that kind of took them off that took the heat off, you know, which was disappointing because they had some money, so it's more of a conventional film, but it's dark, it's serious, it's violent, it's got the all-black cast, nobody's really a superstar in it. And that really hurt them, unfortunately. So Dead Presidents is really the movie that they spent their capital on. And then they were forced to do the for-hire gigs, which now would have been Akira. They were going to do Akira, and they did Book of Eli, and they did From Hell. So, you know, I don't think they're terrible filmmakers at all, but, you know, this was like... And you know, no, Jamie, there is a scene where I did wish that... You know, Mark Wahlberg would furrow his brow and just be like, this city, it's, why is it so broken, you know? But
he doesn't. I am disappointed that the movie is not actually set in Broken City, you
know? No.
Now, see, I guesstimated from the trailer. I saw the lead credits here. You see, you know, Marky Mark, you know, Fat Guy and Superman, Michael Douglas's eighth wife. And I noticed Barry Pepper was the fourth, and yet Barry Pepper is nowhere in the credits. So I'm going to guess and say he's the bad guy.
Incorrect!
Damn it!
Incorrect. And see, this is why, because this is kind of a mature movie, you know, so the plot goes in plausible, serious directions. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Arbitrage from last fall. I don't know if you guys saw that one with Richard Gere. And there's so much real stuff about it. It's like, I don't know if you guys have seen the films of James Gray.
No.
I've heard of him.
Oh, he's brilliant. He's brilliant. He does these crime films, and he did a film a little bit like this called The Yards, also with Mark Wahlberg and Joaquin Phoenix. And it's about a real crooked deal to secure the rights to these this land in a major city where. You know, there's crooked backroom dealings, whatever, but it's all really small-scale crime. The sort of thing that happens and no one really gives a shit about. And James Gray, you know, I felt like Broken City was, you know, like they reached into James Gray's, like, closet and they grabbed a script and it had a post-it that said, doesn't work, JG. And they just ripped it off and took the script and used it, you know? Like, they just said, fuck it. It's like... A first draft doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Whatever. We'll fly with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a serious movie about adults, for adults. There's no explosions. There's no capes. You know, there's no unnecessary sex scenes. There's a couple of action scenes that feel obligatory. Jeffrey Wright shows up. He's always great. You know, it felt like the sort of
movie they don't really make anymore. And it's disappointing because when this film fails creatively and at the box office, it makes people say, well, that's why they don't make them anymore. You know, bullshit like that. And that's not fair. And that's why I don't want this film to just vanish into nowhere. You know, I thought there's some interesting things going on. And, you know, they're really reaching for an authenticity that's not there. But it's a good try, you know? It's a good try. And it's why I prefer the movies at the beginning of the year, January, February, March, April, because those movies feel the most incomplete. Like they get three-fourths of the way there and then just conk out completely. They're incomplete, they're missing one key element, or they're just, the juju's all wrong, you know, or the third act completely butchers what was already a pretty decent movie, you know. There's always something little. And that something little is always the reason why the studio releases it at such a shitty slot in January, February, March, April. But, you know, it's like doing an autopsy. You know, if watching movies are like doing autopsies, then the movies at the beginning of the year have the most interesting anatomies.
Oh, now I'm watching it.
Exactly. See, there
so
you
I'm
go.
Sorry, Gabe. I'm forgive my ignorance. I'm a little confused. Is this a recommend or isn't it? Because I was intrigued about this one, actually.
This is, you know, if you really want to see something really down and dirty and kind of serious and kind of straight face, then I would definitely, definitely, definitely watch it streaming on Netflix.
I knew there's a line there.
You know, I'm not a guy who recommends a whole lot of stuff. You know, and there's a time and place for everything. Now movie tickets are like, what, $10, $12, $14. I'm not even playing, I'm not paying matinee prices of like $6 for Broken City. But you're definitely going to get your money's worth if you pay $3-4. If you could see it at the Dollar Theater, that'd be fantastic, you know.
But if the theater was more than 5 blocks away, you wouldn't make the trip. You wouldn't walk more than 5 blocks to see this film.
10. I'm going to go with 10.
Oh, it's that's fair.
That's a good one. But like, if you went to like if your friend came over and he was like, let's drop some acid and watch all the Marvel movies. The next day, if you wanted to cleanse your palate, Broken City's a pretty good palate cleanser. You know.
So, Gabe, did you want to stick around for the next part of this, or do you need to shoot off?
I do actually really love Heaven's Gate. I think it's a pretty great picture that deserves its due. I'm not going to lie about that. I'm totally in the tank for Heaven's Gate, but I do have to head out. So, and Heaven's Gate is 8 billion years long, so I can't imagine discussing it.
It's okay, sir. All right, well, you have a great week, sir.
All right, thanks for having me, folks.
Take care. Bye-bye. So, folks, moving on, we sometimes here on the show take for granted the conversations that we have off air and the conversations we have on air. And sometimes we talk about things and we don't realise you haven't been in the room with us the whole time. So I'd better fill in the blanks just before we get on to the next piece of business. A couple of months ago, Jamie introduced us on YouTube to a fantastic documentary about the making and the unmaking of the infamous 1980 film that killed United Artists, Heaven's Gate. Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. I noticed off air that Jamie called him Giacchino. Giacchino is a composer, Jamie.
That's right. Yeah. We both have Oscars. I got mixed up.
We're going to get in a whole Postlethwaite thing here, so just so you know, it's Cimino. But just let me know anytime you need to say the guy's name. So anyway,
I'll call you up.
Of course, people our age have not seen Heaven's Gate. It's I'd imagine, quite a hard film to find on basic cable or even on DVD. It's kind of like it's a dirty little secret that people don't want you to see. And as I understand it anyway, the film has finally released and is shown on TV and things, and this was a pretty butchered version. It was cut down, so there's no real point seeing it. And I've just always known of it, because anybody who loves movies has heard of Heaven's Gate, the law of Heaven's Gate. And of yep. course, as Mr. Mankiewicz says in the documentary, the law of Heaven's Gate is don't make that film, because it'll finish you off. That's how this documentary starts, folks. You can find it on YouTube, and I thoroughly recommend it. It's fantastic. And the great thing about it, for me anyway, I can't speak for the other guys, was it made me want to see the movie. I mean, I think it's quite objective, really. I mean, there's plenty of people who defend the film, and I think they've got a good viewpoint. The people who made it, basically the stars, like Chris Christopherson, the United Artists executives who let this financial $40 million bomb happen. They're quite candid and I think quite fair about it. The only person who isn't interviewed is the director, is Cimino, because he's still this kind of crazy recluse guy. And, well, I mean, I've seen quotes here and there, but it's really hard to judge the guy because he just doesn't speak about the movie, really. And we'll get onto that in a second. So, you watch the documentary. It's quite objective about basically what went wrong. There was a... Cimino had a big ego. It's that much is quite clear. But obviously, he wanted to make a good movie, and he just made something that appears to be incredibly long, incredibly beautiful, but rather pretentious. But something that deserves to be seen for its craft. And by a coincidence, of course, then Criterion this Christmas released Heaven's Gate, the full uncut director's cut version, all 3.5 hours of it. On DVD and Blu-ray, and I thought, well, you know, why not? So I picked it up in New York, and I think, did you as well, Jamie? Did you pick it up?
I did.
You did? So we both sat down to try and watch it, and I'm going to let Jamie start, because we didn't do this together, although we should have, because then we could have pinched each other just to keep each other awake. Jamie, how went your efforts to try and watch Heaven's Gate?
I got about an hour into it, and I can give a little backstory here. I've seen The Deer Hunter, so I mean the movie that made Cimino a huge hot director, and,
which I haven't, so I have to say.
Which I don't, and I don't think I don't think Deer Hunter's that very good of a movie. I mean, I think it has the same basic structural problem as Heaven's Gate, which is confounding to me how people can like insult how people 2 years later went off on the guy for basically making the same, not the same kind of movie, but he structurally made the same kind of problem. It's just so long, like. The images are lush and they're vibrant. They look, the cinematography is gorgeous. And the acting is good, but it just goes to show you that you have to have a good editor in order to cut that thing down, because it felt like I was watching a rough cut of a movie. You know, the first assembly, where you get everything in there, and then you slowly start to cut shit down. And you start to build your pacing and your momentum and everything like that. And I never thought Deer Hunter was that good of a movie, but at least I could finish that film. I couldn't finish Heaven's Gate. I got about an hour into it, and what I sort of took from the beginning of the movie was that Kris Kristofferson's character is this, he's a man of luxury, a man of wealth, and yet he sympathizes with these immigrants who are coming here trying to begin a life for themselves and their children. And everyone else is hating on them. He comes from a higher class. He feels bad for them, and he wants to help them. I felt like, you know, the first 50 minutes, I mean, that never came across until the hour mark of the movie.
Mm.
I mean, you have the opening prologue where they're all graduate, him and John Hurt. You can tell you know they're young because John Hurt has wavy hair. and Kris Kristofferson has no beard. So,
that's right.
That's right. So,
well, also, graduating. Don't forget, they do say 3 years later. That helps. Just so you know.
No, they say, no, it's 20 years later.
Oh, is it 20 years? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I must have blinked. Never mind.
That's the problem, you blinked.
I mean, we should mention, basically, if we can, what the plot is. And Jamie's absolutely right. The reason why Jamie feels the way he does is because it isn't till about an hour in the movie actually reveals what the friggin' plot is, which is basically that, basically what Cimino's saying is the United States government has come up with this roster of thieves and killers, basically all living in Johnson County that need to be eradicated. It's a big hit list.
And all they are just people from
Slavics,
immigrants.
Yeah.
Immigrants here trying to begin a new life for themselves. And
you basically have this friggin' Darth Vader motherfucker who's dressed all in black and has a black handlebar mustache and is completely one-dimensional.
Well, that's that's played by Sam Waterston.
Yes, yes, and he's the villain. It's very subtly done, and he just stomps around. He just hides a bunch of...
There's a line of dialogue that goes...
Well, no, he actually, he does, believe it or not, folks, you won't believe this. I mean, and if you've seen The Simpsons, it would make you laugh. He slaps...
John Hurt.
And no, he slaps Kris Kristofferson with a glove.
That's right.
That's right. When
I remember what he said. He said, "Your mama's so fat."
It's kind of like that. No, the line is more like, "I can appreciate men like you," or something. And Chris Scovinson says, "You can't appreciate a guy like me. You'd have to die and be born again." And then he gets slapped with a glove. And then Chris Christopherson gives him
slaps him back, but apparently his slap is a lot harder because he's Chris Christopherson.
And he's awesome in this, by the way. He is. I mean,
he is good.
He tries his damnedest. And Christopher Walken is Christopher Walken. He's good when he turns up, which...
He's not in it that much.
Well, in the first half, he's barely in it. In the second half, he does show up a bit more, but you didn't get that far, Jamie, so you wouldn't.
I've seen the movie straight. I mean, like, I've seen bits and pieces. Like, I've seen the ending, and I've seen, like, spoiler alert, I saw Christopher Walken's death scene. It was pretty good, actually. You know, really creepy shit.
So anyway, back to the plot. Yeah. So that's what we were saying. Basically, the government has this hit list, which is basically, you know, they're pretending it's all in the course of justice, and they're just going to Johnson County, which Chris Christopherson is protecting, just to get rid of some thieves and stuff. But really, they're out to eradicate the entire population. And you basically, for 3 hours, they're building up to a big fight. That's all it is, folks. It's nothing more complicated than that. And I think Jamie and I are going to agree, when we actually get to the battle sequences at the end, they're pretty spectacular. I was very, very impressed.
But it goes on and on and on and on and on.
It does. But it's. I think what impressed me, Jamie, I mean, it was something that I hadn't seen before, because most of the people who are fighting against the government forces, most of the people that you seem to see anyway, are women. It's weird, like that, but most of them appeared to be like just happy homemakers in Jamie says, just innocent immigrant women in schmucks carrying shotguns and rifles and things, just defending their turf. And
well, we see that scene in the beginning where like one of them, the husband's literally beaten to death, as we find out, by just locals, and forcing the wife to have to basically take care of herself and her children in their land. And Christopherson's like, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And she's like, "Nope." That she's having to carry,
women of
again,
stronger.
Shit like that is really compounding, and it's good, but it's like, God damn it, dude, get an editor. A real one. You know?
It's the kind of movie where, basically, if a scene's taking place in an upstairs room, we have to see the character go through the front door of the house, and then walk up the stairs, and then go in the room. You know, you can't just start the scene from the room. It's that.
You have to show off, like, how, like, great the art direction is, which it is. I mean, I'm not taking away from it, but, again, there's a thing about pacing and momentum, and this Giacchino just doesn't know what the
fuck
that is.
There you go again. It's Cimino.
Cimino, excuse me. I'm trying to blame him. Yeah, exactly. You and your damn Pixar scores.
Michael Giacchino's crying right now. I didn't have anything to do with it. Poor guy. And it's like, I mean, there's a lot. I can tolerate... No, this is a lie, actually. I say I can tolerate bad movies, but, you know, I've had plenty of rants in my time. But really, you know, I only do it in fun for entertainment purposes. Bad movies don't get to me, but what really bugs me is pretentious movies. Movies that think they're awesome when they're not. And this movie thinks it's great. That's the problem. And I think what kills it, honestly, is the chunk at the start, which didn't need to be there. Basically, before we get to America and Johnson County, we have a whole 20-minute prologue at Harvard where we meet Chris Christopherson, who's graduating, as Jamie says, without a beard, so you know he's younger, and John Hurt with his floppy hair. And there's no point to it. No point. You have people, I mean, it starts obviously with a graduation ceremony, and the headmaster starts a speech which is about nothing, which I could decipher. Then he brings up John Hurt, who's the year's orator, and he has a speech which again is slow and about nothing.
But apparently it's funny because everyone laughs.
Exactly, and we're just dumbfounded by it. It's one of those things where, of course, you know, as one of the big handicaps that you always have with a period piece is that people, you know, making movies today don't really know how back then spoke.
Yeah.
So they go one or two ways. Either they speak contemporary and the writing's so good that you're not bothered by it, or they speak in ye olde times and ye olde ways, and it comes off as either pompous or impenetrable, and this is both, and it's pretentious as well. And after the speech, then we get some dancing, a lot of dancing, and then I think the guys have a fight, like a friendly fight, and John Hurt and Chris...
They have to get on top of a tree.
That's right, something like that, and then...
James! You keep saying James! Keep saying
and then boy. After that, they're all in a big crowd singing to the girls who are in a window.
All night long.
All night long!
We're not exaggerating. They sing to them in the day, and the girls are... Oh! And then we fade out, and it's nighttime, and they're still fucking singing. Don't believe me? Buy the Criterion. Or Netflix.
Oh,
save yourself
no,
some
oh, yeah. The movie's on Instant, by the way. Also, I attempted to watch this myself over the weekend, and I could not even get through the first 10 minutes. So, but yeah, Phil, you're absolutely right. The worst thing is pretension. I mean, the problem, you know, you don't want to rely on that word too much because, again, I think some people, that word gets really abused a lot. When people can't seem to, when it's sometimes dealing with complex stuff where the movie is not, you know, maybe it's not clear, you know, it's not ultra explicit about what it's trying to do. Like, you could see, like, the word pretension used a lot like The Master. And I think, you know, some people could successfully argue that it was. But again, it's a term that can be used as a crutch very easily.
But
I'm not denying that the Heaven's Gate is not pretentious. That's absolutely no. This is absolutely true.
You wouldn't call a film like Prometheus pretentious. That's not fair.
No. I also and there are movies that think they're trying to be something and they're not. And a great example of that is like Southland Tales, where it's pretentious but stupidly pretentious. And you have to also look at the time. I think this may have been a right around when Heaven's Gate. I recall Heaven's Gate being the watershed moment, not only of the movie that killed United Artists, but that also ended the renaissance of the 70s.
It was a number of movies, actually. That was the one that ultimately did the straw that broke the camel's back. But you had like...
Yeah, but it's talked about in Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Yeah, 1941, you had you had Sorcerer. I mean, granted, there was Apocalypse Now and Blues Brothers. But
that
those
was successful.
But yeah, those two movies were very successful, so they don't really count.
And that's actually one of the great points that the documentary makes, is that, you know, these poor United Artists executives, the one hope they were clinging on to the entire time they saw their entire fortune go down the drain was that, but we're going to have a great movie at the end of it, which is admirable in a way. You know, even if it doesn't make money, I mean, we're going to have something that's going to be put on a pedestal, something that's going to be built to last, something that will ensure our legacy as a studio that did release so many fantastic movies, especially in the 70s, and it's not here. And I will say one thing to its credit, though. You can't say that it's an 80s movie or a 70s movie. It is, I mean, it doesn't feel like it's been made in any particular decade. It's not even a 60s movie. It is what it is. It looks like a piece of history. I'll give it that. It looks spectacular. It really, really does. The problem, it's just the... I mean, I just think the first 20 minutes sums it up. I mean, it's the kind of... I guess what the point's supposed to be is that... Oh, look, I'm going to spoil things here for you folks. By the end of the movie, John Hurt's dead, and Chris Christopherson is basically a hollow man. And I'll get back to the ending of the film in a second. Oh, boy, will I. But I guess after this 20-minute Harvard prologue, we then cut to Chris Christopherson with a beard... on a train, heading back.
He's in a train by himself, and everyone else is on top of the train.
On the roof, yes.
He's on a train, which, again, is symbolizing this idea that he is so wealthy and rich that he can buy out the whole thing and everyone else can't.
Symbolism!
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, the point, I guess, I mean, you tell me, Jamie, I guess the point of the Harvard prologue is just to say that, you know, once we were young and we were free and we could do what we want and we had a whole future ahead of ourselves.
I don't know. Once him and John Hurt meet again, it's almost like nothing's changed.
Maybe the Harvard prologue is to show the aristocracy in America. Maybe that's what it is.
That's not even a theme in the movie, though, so I don't... It just felt like when you see Christopherson on the train, it's like he's been dreaming. Like, he's been asleep, so he's been dreaming of Harvard. He's been dreaming of happier times. You can do that in 5 minutes. You know, that's... As you
exactly.
Said, you can. I mean, you don't even have to say it at all. You could have lost that thing completely. I would like to... I don't know. I've not seen, obviously, the cut-down version that's, like, just about 2.5 hours or something. But I would be at all surprised if that version is missing this 20-minute Harvard prologue completely. I wouldn't be surprised if it just stopped.
I think it's still in there. It's just not as long.
You could certainly say that. I mean, another perfect example, just before we get to the ending, is there's a stretch in the middle when we find, but believe it or not, I don't think we get to actually meet the people of Johnson County until 90 minutes into
the... That's the problem. That's the other problem, is that, you know, we're supposed to, I know Chris Christopherson's your lead character, but we're supposed to understand the plight of these people and what his plight with them. You know, why he's putting his neck on the line as a man of stature and wealth to bring himself down to defend these people. Why wait 90 minutes to bring him in? That's just ridiculous. You need to bring them in 20 minutes into the movie. Truthfully sooner than 20 minutes, but like I would, because it's a long movie, go, all right, the 20-minute mark, then we start getting around to this situation. And it doesn't even do that. As you said, 90 fucking minutes.
And what we have then, by the way, it's not like we meet them briefly. It's like we... this is like, it makes the Harvard prologue feel like freaking, I don't know, Speed Racer or something. It's crazy. What happens then is basically they all get together in the town hall, and then they have a dance, and they have a dance, and they dance, and
they roller
dance.
Skate.
And they roller skate, yes, that's true. And they dance, and they dance, and they dance till they can't dance no more. And then the evening's over, and you think, okay, time to move this story along. And all that's left at the town hall are basically Chris Christopherson and Isabelle Huppert, his girl. And then they have a dance by themselves, and they dance till they can't dance no more. You want to kill yourself. I defy any... Look, film is subjective, so fair play to the people who've seen it recently, the critics, and they've said, this is a forgotten masterpiece. I'd love to know where you're coming from. Gabe thinks it's great. I'd love to know where he's coming from. I don't see it. I just don't see it at all. It's not engaging. It's just sitting there. It is.
Phil, what it reminds me of, I think, is like when people talk about Terrence Malick a lot. Mm-hmm. So when you've seen a Terrence Malick film, and the only movie I've ever been able to finish of his is Badlands, where, again, you know what a Terrence Malick movie is, where it's a lot of shots of wheat fields and voiceovers, and, like, you wonder, it's like, what is it about the appeal of this? Absolutely nuts. And you almost feel like either those people are nuts, or I'm an idiot. It's like, I don't understand it. I don't, because you feel like this, I mean, it looks great.
You know what it is?
There's nothing else to it.
You know what it is? It's that bit from American Beauty where, like, Wes Bentley tapes the fucking...
the plastic bags.
The plastic bag. That's what it is. I mean, like, see what it means? Look at it!
And by the way, that's a point there which I think we should address just briefly, is that you should never feel that way about a movie. I mean this to absolutely everybody. You know, movies... movies should not make you feel stupid. If you don't understand it, it's the movie's failed. You haven't failed. The movie's failed to engage with you. Because I truly believe that, you know, it doesn't matter how smart you are, intelligence doesn't come into it. If a movie's going to be successful, it engages with you. And that's a subjective thing. So
I think that really depends on the audience, of course. I mean, you know, who was the audience for Heaven's Gate? I mean, maybe it was the idea of continuing off of the attitudes and the views of the audiences of the early 70s that were just not, that maybe somehow could, I just don't know how they could have stomached a 3-hour plus movie like
about
that.
This subject, who wanted to see a movie about the Johnson County War? Who knows about the Johnson County War?
But there's a thing, yeah, it's like we don't know about it, but like you can still make a confounding, interesting story. I mean, here's an example. Who the hell knew the story of Oscar Schindler? Fucking nobody. And yet,
yeah, right.
The movie comes out and we're like, this happened? A guy actually spent, like, his entire fortune to save these people?
I mean, you're absolutely right. The unknown events probably make the best stories because no one knows about them. Like, what, you know, why would anyone want a 2.5-hour movie about, of course, you could have said the same thing about Titanic, but I guess you were able to build enough of a story around the Titanic that it was worthwhile, even though that movie was very long. But, you know, you're right, though, like I said about the earlier events. I just know, I think at that time also you had really, it was almost, I mean, and then you also, I mean, prior to that you had those very long epic movies. You had,
right.
You know, Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, you did El Cid, you know, the Ten Commandments.
But I would argue, I think, the difference is like a movie like El Cid can hold your attention, I would argue. Lawrence of Arabia can hold my attention. Spartacus can hold my attention, because those are great movies that I understand. I keep saying this word again, but it just it bears repeating. I understand pacing. And Giacchino, Bill's looking at me so angry right now. They understand that.
I don't even think it's a question of that, dude. I mean, I've been racking my brain about this. We knew what we were getting into. I'm like, we were prepared. We'd seen that documentary multiple times. We knew the movie was going to be long and baggy and badly paced.
It's like Cleopatra, you know, same thing.
Oh, God, yeah.
We love that documentary, and we knew the history of it. So
I can't get through that movie.
You can't get through Cleopatra. I guarantee you can't. If you do...
Fair play to
you. I don't know what your doctor prescribed to you, but I'd like some.
And I mean, the worst thing, I think, of course, the thing that can always kill your movie, you can have a bad beginning, but as we got into the climax, I was really engaged by the battle sequences, and even though I didn't really know or like these characters, I was still affected by seeing these poor women, innocent women, getting their heads blown off so callously. I mean, there's one shot even when there's a wife is basically trying to drag her husband from the battlefield. She gets shot, and then we quickly cut to this guy who's just, you know, writing on his list of people who've died. He's just writing casualties. It's so callously done, but it's really, really effective. And there's a bit where right at the end of the final battle sequence, one of the women who managed to survive blows her own brains out in silence, which is really, really effective. It's really, really well done. And at the end, basically, all that's left are Jeff Bridges, Kris Kristofferson, and Isabelle Huppert. And they're about to leave, and then on their doorstep, Darth Vader shows up and shoots at them again. And again, Jeff Bridges goes down, Isabelle Huppert goes down, and Kris Kristofferson's left. And yes, I mean, he cradles his dead loved one and almost yells at the sky, and you think, okay, yeah, that's fine, that's an ending, like maybe one more shot of him riding off into the sunset going back home, but then we cut to basically a really nice posh ship, and it's I don't know how many years later is this, I've really forgotten what the subtitles are, but it's certainly a few. He looks a bit older, he's got some grey in the hair. I forget whether he had the beard or not, but he's older. Basically.
No, he lost the beard.
Oh, he lost the beard. Okay, fair enough. But he's rich.
He's married to the girl who he's wooing at the beginning of the movie.
Ah, right. Gotcha. See, when you watch the movie in bits, you kind of lose track of these things.
You gotta take notes.
You do. You really do. But
there will be a test at the end of the screening.
Oh, God.
That's why it flopped. Nobody wanted to fucking like take a test after the movie. It was like going to IRS Burger. What it was.
Basically the point of the scene is that he's still rich, you know, he's got this lovely, he can do what he wants, he's managed to survive, he's basically going to have a comfortable life from this point on, and he's married to what appears to be a lovely lady, but he's not happy. And again, how long do we spend on this ship making this point with no dialogue whatsoever? 10 minutes?
We have that wonderful, we have that music, which, to be fair, the music is fantastic.
The music's fantastic, but it's slow music. It's slow music. Oh, yes. And music is very important. Like, I'm not saying you needed to overdub this with a Hans Zimmer score. That would have been weird. But I'm saying that, having slow music to a slow movie is only going to make it seem even slower. And also, it's one of those movies where, you know, Michael Cimino has, like, 3 or 4 credits in the opening credits, because it's not Heaven's Gate. It's Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. A bedtime
really
story.
On that movie.
as you said earlier, I mean, the 70s was the time of the director, because the studio system imploded, so they were depending on these directors to make these really low-budget films, but as the films got more successful, their egos inflated, so they were able to demand more costs, a blank check, and then things went and they got out of hand. Of course, it's my favorite decade of film is the 70s because of that. We got some fantastic movies, the ones that we all know, the little ones that nobody talks about. But also, you know, at the end of the decade, it's so funny how, like, by the time the decade was over, we were transitioning to what we now have. We've had them for the last 30 plus years now, which is the modern day blockbuster. And it's funny how, like, you know, even those films back then, you know, there was a lot of heart put into it. It wasn't a cynical. There was a real attempt to make really great movies that just happened to please everybody.
people were so used to downer endings that you have someone like George Lucas and Spielberg and Dick Donner come along and say, I want to make a movie that's upbeat and like, and the good guys can win and crowd pleasers. And, but there's a lot of thought put into it, and there's a lot of great writing and performances. And I'm getting off topic here. I apologize.
Not at all. Not at all. But I was just going to make the point that I don't think things have changed much at all. People can make that argument, but you still have, as Ed was pointing out, movies getting made like The Master. Now, please tell me, you can't tell me that anybody gives money to pull Thomas Anderson thinking that they're going to get it back multiple times. No, they're just, he's a good filmmaker. He makes very interesting movies.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you think that you're going to win awards from it. That's what it comes down to. That's what it all comes down to. That's why, that's really why, you know, Heaven's Gate got made ultimately. Because, I mean, Deer Hunter was a huge hit. It won a lot of Oscars.
And but we want to work with that guy.
We want to work with that guy, and you know what? He could win another Oscar. I mean, right. it's basically what just happened right now, which we're seeing as we speak with Zero Dark Thirty and Les Mis, which was on paper. These were the follow-ups to these directors' huge Oscar-winning blockbusters, and everyone thought, oh, well, they're going to win again. And I never thought either one of them.
Wait, The Hurt Locker was never a huge blockbuster.
That's true, actually. That's a good point.
A better example would have been The Master, because that was the follow-up to There Will Be Blood, which won awards.
That's absolutely true. But you know what I'm getting at, though.
Yeah.
The point is, interesting movies that are director's visions are getting made. You just don't feel the need to say Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. You know, I just hate that pretentious bullshit. Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. Like, anybody else was going to make it. And we must make the distinction. It's my Heaven's Gate. Not as opposed to, like, I mean, it'd be funny, wouldn't it, if they made Heaven's Gate today, you'd have that company that makes the rip-off versions. Like, they do their own version. Asylum Films. What would Asylum Films' version of Heaven's Gate be?
Honestly, 10 seconds. When you say Heaven's Gate, it did get remade, as I think, because there's that Battle of the Hatfield and the McCoys. I think that feud is
which was successful. That was the difference. That was a big hit.
And that was a TV movie. That was a series of TV movies that just came out fairly recently.
Yeah, my parents loved that, actually. Everyone I've spoken to have seen that, including my folks, loved it.
Yeah, that was a huge hit, I think.
Yeah, it was. It's part of Costner's comeback, actually.
Yeah.
He's coming back, folks. You watch.
I mean, there's definitely going to be always directors that do their own thing, and it's definitely not going to be for everyone.
Right.
You know, I have no one knows what they're
doing. Well, I mean, you know, for example, let's look at Roman Polanski. I mean, he's been doing his own thing for years. You know, I mean, basically living in Europe, but it's like, do his movies really make money? I don't. I mean, I'm sure one or two of them do.
They win occasional awards, but you're right. They don't make.
But they make them. They make them because he is this auteur director. And they, you know, it's about the arts. But I mean, you know, everything you guys are saying is absolutely true.
Well,
it doesn't seem as much as we have these auteur directors as much as we used to in the 70s. Not that we don't have them, but I mean, maybe it's the thing about the 70s is that that's all they were making. Again, studios were taking risks because what were the sure things back then were star vehicles that, you know,
musicals.
And, you know, science fiction was kind of nothing. The only thing that was science fiction that was successful was Planet of the Apes. And even that was over. I mean, basically,
giant epics
were gone. The only sure thing, and this is just funny how the more things change, the more they stay the same. The only sure thing during the 70s was actually James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Yeah.
Even then, you know, it's like, I mean, we went through a period where the disaster epics, you know, when Irwin Allen just pumped those fuckers out and, you know.
That he made the swarm.
Exactly. Well, he also made Beyond the Poseidon Adventure starring Michael Caine.
And Terry Savalas.
That's right.
As the villain, mind-blowing as that sounds.
I know, shockingly.
But anyway, we've talked about the film, but there is a bigger issue at hand here, which we're not the first people to talk about.
It's offensive, I gotta say. It's offensive.
Well, let's start the ball rolling, Sid, because you seem pretty upset.
Well, I mean, the fact the Criterion doesn't even want to label the fact. They don't even want to go into the history of how the film was a failure. It's almost like it's a non-issue. It doesn't exist. If you go by the Criterion, it was this amazing movie that came out in 1980 that we're giving that's now getting its due. Mm. And that's even without saying that the documentary final cut, the making and unmaking of Heaven's Gate, was not included. I understand why you couldn't include that. What's the channel? IFC produced it. Mm. It's wonderful. You can go see it for free on YouTube right now. After you listen to this podcast, go check it out, guys. I promise you'll really get into it. But
It's not included?
No.
Okay, fine. Well, maybe they'll make their own documentary. They'll do their own little thing. Nope. No. I mean, what do they have, Phil? You tell me. What's there?
What do we have
to represent?
I'll tell you, sir. We basically have on... It is a two-disc version, even the Blu-ray. It's two discs. And on that second disc, you basically have an hour's worth of content. You have a half-hour new interview with Michael Cimino. It's not an on-camera interview, interestingly enough. It's basically an off-camera interview set to still images from the film, where he just talks about the making of the film in his rather slow, ponderous way, which at no point actually mentions, really, the production difficulties of the film, just his vision and his intentions, which, obviously, you know, it's fair enough, it's his viewpoint, you can't force him to talk about something he doesn't want to talk about.
Yes,
fair
no,
enough.
What offends me, though, in all seriousness, I mean, like, they did a blowout Criterion about a year ago, which was great.
Mm.
And there's not a commentary with De Palma, and there's not a documentary, and I understand that, because De Palma just doesn't do that shit, and I get that, that's fine. But what they did do was they had an interview with De Palma, and I forget which filmmaker interviewed him. Some filmmaker from today.
Someone De Palma will actually talk to.
That's true, actually. And they sit down and they talk for, I think, 30 or 40 minutes. And they go into that. They go into that and say, well, the movie wasn't successful, was it? And he goes, no. And they go into the details. Like, you know, and he says, like, you know, the ending to, which is the best part. I don't say the best part of the movie. It's one of the great points of Blowout, which is a great movie. Is the fact the movie ends on probably the downer of downer endings, I would argue, is Blowout. And he says that, you know, that's why it failed. We put it out in the summer, middle of summer, and it has a dark ending where John Travolta doesn't save the girl, and he's sad, and he's lost, and he's lonely, and he's
disturbed. And has permanent physical and mental scarring, probably.
Yeah. And that's the end. And, I mean, that was the first thing I thought of when I saw the movie is, oh, my God, but in a great way. Like, oh, my God, that's the ending? Wow, that's great! But, you know...
The point is, when you're done with all the supplementary features on Blowout,
yeah.
You know everything you want to know about the making of that film.
Yes.
That's the point. What we have with Heaven's Gate is a huge omission. So we have that half-hour interview. Then I thought, and this was the part that I was really looking forward to, there's an interview, a new interview with Chris Christopherson, who's a great presence on the documentary that we've been talking about on YouTube. And I thought, well, if Cimino's not going to talk about it, Chris Christopherson's certainly not going to avoid the issue. He has his own personal... feelings about the movie and feels that
he was upfront about it.
That he feels that that Heaven's Gate was used as an excuse by the studio system to stop making that kind of picture, which is fair enough. It's a very interesting viewpoint, but he was quite honest about, you know, certain things in it. That interview's 10 minutes with him on the Criterion disc. 10 minutes. And then there's some other things, but, and of course, you also have the one final hope with every Criterion movie, you also get a pretty detailed booklet with it in the inside, written by either a film historian or a critic or somebody who basically is, you know, has a passion for the film or is closely affiliated with the film, and you feel like there's one place where you're going to get disclosure and honesty, it's there, and you don't get it there either. So what you have here is something that just feels like a smokescreen. It's not honest. It feels, and actually feels, if this is possible, more pretentious than the film itself, because it feels like not only is Criterion's... Well, of course, Criterion's mission is to say, we pick the best. We pick the best of foreign and American cinema, and, you know, we put it out there for people to either rediscover or discover for the first time. By putting Heaven's Gate on disc, but not addressing its clear flaws and the fact that not everybody enjoys it and the fact that it was a nightmare production, just feels incredibly dishonest. And also, as if not only is Criterion saying Heaven's Gate is not a bad movie, it's like, well, we wouldn't dare put it on disc if it was what you think it is. How dare you accuse us? You know, it's wrong. And the worst thing of all is that in this day and age, Criterion discs are still bloody expensive, which is fine because you're paying for movies that...
Well, it's very true, Phil. Or has been significantly upgraded. I mean, you look at a great example is that they just recently announced that they're going to put out Repo Man. You know, one of my favorite movies.
Yes.
But the thing is the features are not that great. They're old features from other discs. You know, I have the DVD I have, which is from a Focus Features release, has pretty much the same features as the Repo Man disc. I may have mentioned this before on the show. I likely did that. The Criterion has not been doing the features that they used to. I don't know if it's out of laziness. I don't know if it's out of just that maybe they can't get the rights or it's a timing. I mean, that whole company is a world unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one knows how they think, and, you know, it's kind of a joke. Why, you know, what are they going to pick? Which is what that, why it's so great to look at pick criterions, that fantastic Tumblr blog. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. And as I said, it's been this odd trend of just that they've not really any features. You get a nice looking box, that's about it. I mean, you don't really get, and you're right. There is an added cost, and to me, it's like paying for, I think it's still the case for like shows from HBO. The DVDs are ridiculously expensive. I can't recall if they still are now. They probably are, though.
Well, I mean, it's not like, I mean, to give them their due, I mean, you are paying for, obviously, the film itself in the best possible, you know, sound and picture presentation you can get. I'm sure that this new version of Repo Man looks absolutely splendid. But, yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't mind if this, you know, then, there's a problem or a rights issue here with extras, but when you clearly have an opportunity, look, for a lot of the right reasons and a lot of the wrong reasons, Heaven's Gate is a seminal American film, and they have not done a good job with it. And
I think maybe the logic is that they could be thinking about one of two ways here. It's like they're going to be thinking, well, it's not our, you know, they're not running an expose here. They're running to re-release the movie to give it a good-looking treatment. You know, they're not here to grill the director, and if the director's not interested in talking about it, you know, what are we going to do? And maybe the other line of thinking is like, look, there's already so much out there that's been discussed. It's like, you know, why, you know, what are we going to, you know, why even bother? It's like, and I'm sure they're not going to say on the DVD, if you want to know more, please refer to these other sources. They're not going to do that. No DVD ever has said that.
No.
But That's what I'm thinking. It's got to be one of two things. I'm sure they considered looking into it, but maybe it's like Cimino wouldn't play ball, so.
So get, you know, someone, like, else, you know, to talk about it. Get those United Artists executives and do a sole interview with those guys.
Exactly.
Maybe it was because if they wanted Cimino's okay, who knows? It could have been a rights thing, or maybe, like I said, it was that there's so much material out there that there's no. It's like we're going to be repeating ourselves. So they just thought, you know what? You know, people are aware of the history of this thing. We're not going to go over it again. We're going to just, you know, embrace what we have.
Which is a bullshit assumption.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can think of it justifying. But then they should have just said that, so they can just cut the.
To be fair though, it is more. It is more fascinating to hear about the unmaking of a movie, how a failure comes about, and a big failure. It's. I think it is. I mean, I made the joke a while back on Facebook and Twitter with Ed, but I mean, you know, I'm not even kidding when I say this, but I mean, like, you know, Ishtar is really something that really lends itself to a Criterion Edition because how does one make a movie like Ishtar? That's a fascinating subject to talk
well,
about.
Well, yeah, and there's been definitely, you know, press about that. Plus, no one ever talks about Ishtar the way they talk about Heaven's Gate. And Ishtar is god-awful.
Ishtar didn't kill a studio. It didn't even kill the careers of its two actors. It killed its director's career. I mean, but that's about it, though. I mean, everyone except for the director came back to do other things. Geely's another similar one, which is, you know, I've never actually sat through all of Geely. It wasn't particularly good, but was it this disaster when played up? No.
Well, I don't think the making really of that film was a problem. There was no real, I don't think there was any actual production problems with it. So it's probably not that good a story. It's just, for whatever reason, timing-wise, it just came out at a bad time.
The movie's just terrible. Then also it had bad timing, but.
Like that movie Warren Beatty made a couple of years ago. Like, was it Town,
yes, and Town and County?
Town and Country, yeah.
Town and Country, yeah, which was
$120 million romantic comedy.
Oh my God.
Had tons of reshoots and they changed directors and all that stuff. And it came out and did like, you know, $3 million.
I think what I'm saying, Criterion, is please do Cutthroat Island. Please.
That would be a great one. You know,
would be.
Again. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, maybe one day. I mean, didn't they do Harold and Maude not too long ago?
They just did Harold and Maude.
See that? There you go.
It doesn't have anything with Bud. There's no Bud Cort commentary. There's not much in the way of features on that DVD.
They're slipping. It's terrible.
Well, that's, I mean, something like Harold and Maude, I mean, it's such an influential movie. You could easily get the filmmakers who grew up watching it and then, you know.
Yes!
you can easily get them to talk about it. And it's like,
yeah,
that's not...
I think they do.
Or like, you know, get someone like Elvis Mitchell. He's a cool guy. He's a film critic. I like him a lot. Like, get him to talk about it.
No, of course, like, and if the film's old enough, they're not going to have the actual filmmaker. They're going to have, like, a historian, like, or... I mentioned that when I watched Island of the Lost Souls. They had a great film, a very charismatic film historian talking about... I mean, this guy knew so much, he knew the exact pay rates of all the players involved. You know, Charles Laughton made so much per week compared to Bela Lugosi, which also made so much per week. You know,
that's fascinating.
We all don't need to see Richard Schickel just come in and like give commentaries for everything. I mean, no offense, buddy.
I mean, Ed's just given me an idea for a supplemental feature for Heaven's Gate. If Chris Gustafson's claim is true, that basically Heaven's Gate was used as an excuse to stop a certain kind of movie making where the director had power, I would imagine there'd be a lot of directors who were pissed off about that and felt those repercussions. Let's hear from them. Let's get some interviews from those dudes, because that's not detrimental to the movie. On the contrary, that's defending Cimino's intentions. How can I, just a putz like me, be coming up with better ideas that's on the fucking disc that professionals
maybe,
are paid to...
Maybe the other reason is that, because it was Heaven's Gate that not only... I mean, it broke Cimino. It, you know, that killed it for him, because he's never... The only other movie I think of note that he made was Year of the Dragon, which is not a good movie. So... It's
a lot of directors only have one good one in them. There's plenty of examples.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Anyway, we spent a lot of time on this. I'm sorry if that bored you, folks, but you know, we got heated up about this because it's, you know, most studios these days, as has been proven, and Robert Meyer Burnett, when he had him on the show, he talked about this, say that most studios and their releases don't give a flying fuck about supplemental features anymore. It doesn't make money. What's the point of doing them? So you'd think, you know, the last bastion that always does give a shit, Criterion.
Who started it?
Thank you. When their standards start to slip, you start sweating. You start sweating. You really do. I mean, what was the best review disc they did this year? The Blu-ray of Brazil. But that's just a port of what their old version of Brazil.
Which is one of the best things they ever did. Absolutely. But yeah, it's from like 1993. I mean, that's how old it is, folks. Or mid-90s. I mean...
To be fair, though,
I mean, at least they had the... I mean, like, there are a few times where... they'll have the courage to say, look, they redid Seven Samurai, and I don't think they fucked up the first time. It was a case where, look, I mean, when they did the first Seven Samurai Criterion Laserdisc, it was a different thing, and they had a lot more material presented to them, they had more commentaries, they had a better, transferred print. I used to have the single disc of that movie, but now I have the three discs, because it's like, why not? It's a great movie. It's a perfect movie. Like, you know, of course I want to buy that. I have no problem with someone doing that.
Anyway, Heaven's Gate, in stores now. Buy it, kids. Please, we've certainly sold it on you. But that does bring us on to something rather sad. Basically, this week marked what is essentially, without sugarcoating it, the death of stores in the UK where you can buy... rent, or even just browse through DVDs, Blu-rays, and even music. The last store that we had left after the recession, physical store, was HMV. I did not count Blockbuster into this because Blockbuster was, as far as I was concerned, already DOA. We'd had a chat about this. In America, Blockbuster went through bankruptcy protection. I think, was that Chapter 11 or Chapter 7? I'd forgotten which one.
Oh, no, I can tell you right now. Chapter 11 is reorganization.
That's
Chapter
the one.
Chapter 7 is liquidation.
Where they blow up the stores, yes, that's right. Well, it was Chapter 11. And I thought, well, you know what, that's what we're only talking about the States, but it's going to happen in the UK, and frankly, let it burn, because it's not very good. But of course, you know... Now, you know, it feels very, very sad. So this week we actually saw, basically, HMV have gone into administration, Blockbuster have gone into administration, and another firm called Jessop's, which is basically the last place in this country where you can really get film developed, actual photos that you take on a camera. That's the last one of those. They're gone as well. And HMV at the moment is looking for a buyer, so they're not completely dead. And I should also mention that a company called Game which I think is part of the HMV group, but I'm not quite sure. I think it is. But anyway, Game Through went through this last year where it seemed like they were dead, and basically they came back. They closed half their stores, but they're still around, and they picked themselves back up. So the HMV is not dead and buried yet, but as it stands right now, stores are closing, stores are getting ransacked. You can't get in their website, so if you've pre-ordered stuff like Skyfall from HMV like I did, you can't even get on the website to cancel your pre-order. They've not taken any money, but obviously, yeah, I've got to wait and see what happens. I mean, I'm not going to order it again when HMV's website might pop up again in a week or two's time and they'll send it to me. So I'm going to wait and see what happens on that. But it's very, very sad. And Blockbuster, same thing. You know, they're undergoing, well, they're waiting for a buyer. We're going to see what happens with them. Yesterday, my mother, who, you know, I know people are going to find this crazy, still likes to go into a store and physically rent things, and she's been a loyal customer of
this. There is nothing crazy about that. I will defend your mom. I'm the same way.
I know, I was just obviously being snarky about that.
Oh, okay.
You know how some people feel about this, because clearly it's not going to matter when we're old, because we're of the digital age. So right. It's not going to impact us at all. We live with this every day. This is how we do it, and we're going to pass this on to our children. So we knew this was going to happen, but there's still generations like my mother who don't have a Netflix or a Love Film subscription. Mum's going to use my Love Film subscription because they actually still, you know, post you physical discs. Netflix doesn't do that, so she's going to use that, which is something. But, you know, she went to that store that she's been a loyal patron of for 20 goddamn years, only to find it being completely ransacked. The poor staff behind the counter were actually getting abused, verbally, obviously, because they were basically getting cleaned out, and they were trying to find the stock, but they didn't have the codes for the stock, because it was absolute chaos. And when they said to the people that they didn't have that particular item, Mum said that they were accused of being liars, which is just ugly.
That's
so
terrible. Why would someone lie about that?
I agree with you.
Well, that just goes to ignorance. I will say that that's just plain old ignorance and really sad too. I
mean, I've always
especially
felt
I hate to think that it's the person behind the counter, you know, for one thing, knows if they still work for the store that they know they're going to get tossed. I could say that, like, over here, and maybe you've seen this, Jamie, like when a company, like a chain, you know, say like a remember Circuit City when it liquidated, they actually there would be a company that would come out and manage the liquidation. They had their own staff. They would come in.
Right.
There'd be some guy standing on the corner holding the sign, you know, just
we'll debase self-credits.
We'll debase self-credits, exactly. But I would ask, I mean, do you have, in the UK, because I know, Jamie, I know you got them over in your neck of the woods, you know, Redbox, which is like a vending machine.
Those are big. Those are very big.
They have those in the UK or a similar device where it's like an ATM machine for DVDs and video games?
Well, the problem is that has the same problem, though, Ed, as Phil's mentioning, like, our parents going digital. I guarantee my parents have no idea what the hell a Redbox is. They're like, how does that work again? If they ever asked me, I'd be like,
well, the work aid is very self-explanatory. I mean, it's like if your parents go.
Yeah, but you're doing a touch. Well, again, the problem is like you're having to do a touch screen, and like a lot of older people, and I'd say older, but the baby boomer generation, which is our parents, like they don't. I mean, they kind of know computers, but there's still things that they don't fully understand. The whole damn touch screen, like, all right, what do I do now? I was with a buddy of mine maybe about 5 months ago, and there was an older gentleman looking for a movie, and we were waiting in line, and like, you know, we're outside. There's this red box machine. We're getting the raid, and we knew this old man wasn't going to get the raid, so we had to worry about that.
All right.
But he was trying to look for another movie, and he literally looked right past it, and it said it was in. And he goes, I'm trying to find this movie. And I just looked over to the man and I said, sir, which movie are you looking for? He told me, I said, hold on, let me get it for you. It was right in front of him, clear as day. The gentleman just didn't know.
And shouldn't be expected
to. I mean, you gotta get used to it. That's...
This is the thing, Ed. This is their attitude. They should get used to it. I don't think so. I don't think
that's bullshit. Yeah, they shouldn't have to. Yeah.
I mean, I know it makes sense from a business standpoint. If people, I'm not blind to this, folks. If people aren't buying from HMV for obvious reasons, then of course they're going to close. I get it. I get it completely. I just think it's deeply, deeply sad that it's happened.
Well, what sucks about it really is that, I mean, this goes for bookstores more than I think even video stores, is that you don't have the ability to browse and get some ideas, you know, to see what's out there. To, you know, it's a little bit easier with film and DVD because there's so much coverage, but like with books, it's really hard to tell when like something gets a new release unless it's like a huge mega hit book. Like sadly, like a 50 Shades of Grey like book. But you don't necessarily aren't aware of like of other stuff coming through, because I would do that all the time. Now, of course, as soon as I would see it on the bookshelf, I'd go to the library and reserve it, but I would still, you know, look at what's available, like browse. It's like, but, I mean, that's really, to me, where you gotta look at, you know, what the book's about, because that's the one thing I haven't been able to quite figure out. The only resource that's come up that would kind of refer to you to stuff like that is a program called Goodreads, which actually is pretty interesting, but, of course, it's not the same thing.
Well, that's actually, that brings up another point, Ed, that you've just reminded me about, which is the problem that I have. I am an Amazon customer and have been for like 7-8 years, and I enjoy Amazon very much. The only problem I have with Amazon, and it's not necessarily their fault, but if I have no idea what I'm looking for, I can't browse. I can't do it. I don't have
the slightest
idea.
It's too lengthy of a process to browse, because the subjects... they may refer to you for a few things, but you're kind of poking around. But, you know, you kind of, that's the one thing about, like, me, I'm not a music guy, but, and we had this many years ago, and it was such a great resource. I mean, there's still a little bit of extent with that with public radio, is that there was it was a radio station called 103.1 that played, you know, they were known as the indie station. They played all sorts of different music. Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols had a radio show on this thing. And to me, I would listen to the radio because that would be a great resource to get referred to on, you know, different types of music to listen to. I myself am not a music guy. So, and that's another, you know, medium that it's just, you can't rent music. So you're stuck with it if you buy it. And, that's one of those things, it's really hard to check out. Let me rephrase that, because you can check it out on iTunes. Actually, I just undermine my whole argument, because, yeah, you can listen to clips of it on iTunes. It's actually better than going to a store, because you couldn't crack open the CD and just listen to it for free. So, sorry, folks, I just wasted all your time.
No,
not at all.
No, you actually gave them a very good plug, because that's a very useful tool. But there was one story, we were talking about older people before, and there's one story that I want to share with you guys, because it's kind of, it's an interesting debate, and I actually had it with my mother, but I want to know what you think about this. First of all, before I tell the story, I do think it's, what disgusts me the most is that for all this friggin' hoopla that has been going on in this country, and people complaining, and people ransacking the joint, and people calling the staff liars, nobody seems to have really said, oh, I'm sorry that you might not have a job. I mean, that the worst thing is, they don't know, Ed. My mum talked to the staff there, they don't actually know what's going to happen, which is the worst thing. Nothing worse than uncertainty. And I just feel it's terrible that nobody, you know, I know that when we're talking HMV, we're talking like 4,000 jobs are at risk. A Blockbuster, I've got to imagine, is the same.
Yeah.
Jessup's, I have no idea. Probably just Guy Parrish. What's his name? Sigh, sorry, excuse me. It's been so long since we talked. 1 hour photos was like the first one we did. It was ages ago. It was like 2000.
I think it was the first one. I mean, that was 2002.
Right.
Where, you know, it was a surprise to see someone developing film. I was, when you first told me about this, about Jessup's going out of business, this was like, in this day and age, people were still bringing their film in?
What sorcery is this?
Well, not only that, it's like, I've gone into stores, I don't see film displays anymore.
No.
So it's like, who would be going around developing film?
It's really just, you know, like special occasions, like graduation photos and things. I have to imagine for things like that, you don't want that a memory like that stored on your phone. I believe you'd like it on a mantle.
I think there's definitely going to be a need for like professional photographers if you're talking about that, for like special events and headshots and things like that. But and you also want a physical copy of the photo. I mean, you want to go to. There's always a need for that. For me, I've done that where I've converted the digital image on my camera to an actual photo, but it's just something I can hold. But that amazed me again. But you're right. I mean, it's the loss of jobs. And you know, you never want to lose a job. And at the same time, and that's how, you know, life goes. And you know, you can only speak for yourself, but it's like you never want to be at the end, you know, the receiving end of that, where your skill has gone to a dying industry like that. You know, where you find yourself, well, damn, now I'm obsolete. You know, and
what if there's someone out there who, like Tarantino, just dreamed of spending their whole life running a video store, and now they...
I gotta admit, I mean, if there's someone out there like a Tarantino that wanted to run their store, I think there will always be a store. I mean, if there are record stores in this day and age, there are going to be boutique video stores. Now, the thing is that as terrible it was for, say, an older person to try to navigate a Redbox, I get the impression for these boutique stores, these stores are not going to be for those kinds of people where they're, you know, looking for the, you know, that's just because it's that kind of snobbish attitude that can come off from that. But I think, you know, that's going to be around. They're just going to need to go into this real niche territory. I mean, stuff that Netflix is not going to be able to provide. But I definitely believe they're going to be around. I mean, it's like comic book stores, you know, and that they're toy stores and things like that. I think that they're going to be there, but they have to traffic it.
Well, they're going to be in big cities. They're going to be like in your area, in New York and stuff, in Chicago and all those areas like that. Not necessarily in where Phil and I live, which is the middle of nowhere in our perspective areas. You know, it's...
Well, Phil lives in a relatively major city, I have to admit, after seeing it, but, you know, it's definitely not London.
European capital of culture. We were for a while. Anyway, let me tell you this story, because this is rather interesting. One of the reasons why a lot of people are upset about the HMV problem is that a lot of people over Christmas purchased gift vouchers and gift cards. And of course, now HMV is not accepting them. Why people have waited this long to use said vouchers, I have no idea.
Stupid people.
I know, but they're not accepting them. So obviously, people are feeling that HMV has committed theft. They've paid £20 for a voucher, and now it's worth nothing. So anyway, here's a story of how one person dealt with that crisis. Story time, folks. An enraged grandfather yesterday stormed out of a Dublin HMV store with three games in hand after staff refused to accept his voucher. The Irish Independent reports that Eric Nolan purchased a 40 euro... Euros, by the way, not pounds. A 40 euro HMV voucher for his grandson for Christmas and was attempting to spend it on three games. However, when staff said they could not accept the vouchers, as per the administrator's ruling, Mr. Nolan refused to take no for an answer and pressed the point. When he failed to hand it over, he decided to leave the store with the three games. Euro Truck Simulator 2, The Sims 3, and Rail Simulator, some really top titles there. So he left the store with those. Security staff followed him down the street, but were unable to persuade him to hand the games back. Quote, "Someone has made a conscious decision not to pay out on vouchers, and it's despicable. HMV has taken hundreds of thousands of euro from the Irish people this Christmas, and we shouldn't put up with it. We are a nation of sheep, and I was determined to win this." Unquote. In essence, of course, Mr. Nolan is correct. It is easy to excuse policies such as the refusal of vouchers as simply part of the process, but it's not. It's a deliberate, planned strategy designed to save the retailer money at the cost of its customers. Now, my feeling on this, and by all means, guys, disagree with me, but my feeling on this is, yes, HMV have done wrong. You can even make the argument they have committed theft. You don't solve theft by committing theft. I do not understand why people think this is excusable. You know, we've got enough problems in this world without grandfathers ransacking stores just because he can't get his way. It's wrong.
It's not about getting his way. I mean, I agree with you, but it's like, well, then what's the solution? Are they going to give the old gentleman his money back? No. Then where's he left at? So I side with the old gentleman on this.
That's fair enough. I
would not condone the behavior, but it was definitely... They should have done a better job of explaining why. First off, that they should have just said, look, what they should have done with the gift card thing is they should have said, well, we can't let you exchange for merchandise, but tell you what, we'll refund you the money and we'll just call it a day. Because really, that's what I could have sworn. That kind of thing has been done here in the States, but up to a certain point where they repeatedly warn you. It's like, you wait by this time, you know, these things are no longer going to be honored. And you have to, if you want to use them, you need to bring them in by this time. Again, you're warned that if you don't do anything with it, it's going to be worthless. I mean, that is a risk when you buy gift card stuff. I mean, there are even, if you don't ever use a gift card, you're actually charged after a certain point. They'll whittle down the amount set aside. But yeah, it doesn't justify the theft of the store. And it's a complete crap situation. Again, I wish the store had just said, look, we'll refund you the money. There's just no, it should have just been handled out there. That I don't understand.
Well, from my perspective, HMV's balls are in a vice. As I say, it's not them. It's the administrators who've taken them over and are deciding what to do with the company and finding a buyer for them. They're the ones who've put this policy in place.
Well, the PR has been completely shot to hell.
True enough. I just want to read this bit again, because this is a bit that's dumbfounding me. Security staff followed him down the streets. So they left the store and they chased after him. Security staff followed him down the street but weren't able to persuade him to hand the games back. What kind of persuasion tactics were they using, I'd like to know? Come on!
Please
no.
Come back.
On! No. I'll be your friend! No. Oh, you're mean! Is that what they were doing? Just bullshit. It's just like... I mean, I know it's going to be worse press for them if they end up tasering old granddad.
I just imagine like that scene. He's slowly getting away!
Ah, the hell with him.
Oh, great, man.
You're heading to the old mill. No, we're not.
Jeez. We're going anyway.
I have to admit, I can't recall a store closing or a sale like that. Where you have something that mismanaged. I mean, I know it's a risk that can happen when you buy a gift card rather than just, say give someone cash. But it's terrible PR. Yeah.
Well, I imagine if that story took place in America, the story would have ended rather differently. Call me crazy.
Well, there probably would have been violence.
The old man probably had a shotgun. He pulls it out,
one of the stores would have been burned down.
Exactly. This is
the negotiator too. I am not going to jail today. I'm taking my games.
Well, not for the fact that he bought Sims, Simulator.
Yeah.
This time it's personal.
Exactly.
I mean, the thing is, people have that deluded idea that when a store is going out of business, they're going to get some real bargains. That's pretty damn rare.
Nope.
Because mostly that good merchandise is already gone.
Exactly.
Now you're left with the dregs, of whatever the hell's left behind.
Yeah, whatever DVDs are left. Hey, you guys want Garbage Pail Kids the movie? No!
Not really.
You got like 5 copies of that.
Yeah, I know. You guys want Leonard Part 6?
Yes, actually, I do want to see that at some point.
You want that as a criterion?
Yeah, why not? I don't want to see Ghost Dad, that looks horrible, but I'll see Leonard Part 6, it looks interesting.
It's not a good movie.
And Joe Don Baker's in it. How bad can it be? Don't answer that.
I never saw Ghost Dad, but I always just understood, is he a single dad? So if I remember correctly, he's a single dad in the movie, and he's dead, so where are the kids? Are they...
Funny. Actually, I got to tell you something else. I found a lucky find the other day. I actually found an old Empire magazine from June 1990. It was the Dick Tracy issue. So I had to pick it up. And what it also had in it was a summer 1990 preview in it as well of all the other movies that were coming up. And it actually had a little aside for Ghost Dad. I'll read it out right now. I've got it here. What does it say?
Yeah, read it out right now before I get going.
You heard it here, kids. Yeah.
Okay, actually, I want to read two. First of all, the one above that is for The Freshman. Marlon Brando returns as an aging mobster opposite Matthew Broderick as the film student he persuades to become his apprentice. Brando called it the worst movie-making experience of his life, then changed his mind a few days later. Then there's Ghost Dad. TV star Bill Cosby materializes in this $30 million special effects comedy as the ectoplasmic father who wants to provide for the children he left behind. Even director Sidney Poitier and scripter Phil Alden Robinson, Field of Dreams, seem unlikely to resurrect a movie industry insiders are already calling unreleasable. And then... after that, get this, Ghost. Positive word of mouth in the industry has singled this out as a possible summer sleeper. Keep an eye on that one, folks. Might do well.
Wow.
Fascinating.
They called it.
We should have a segment of this where Phil reads an old copy of Empire.
And now, children, as we wrap up, Uncle Phil's going to read from Empire. You know,
from the July 1994 issue.
And this week, children, you know, and we'll play Master
Stargate. Theme.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's all it is. But anyway, folks, if you stuck with us, I think I'm going to call this episode Streets of Rant. That seems like a good that's a good title tonight, because we did ramble on a bit. We were going to talk about that Disney release schedule, but
maybe next week.
And thank you very much for all the kind comments about the Superman retrospective. Cat's out of the bag. It's going to be special, folks. I promise you that. I don't think Jamie fully knew what he was getting into when he said that. Sounds like
I had an idea.
but I mean, it's even if Warner Brothers isn't going to make this the year of Superman, we are. We promise you that. But we'll be back next week with, I don't know, something or other. What's coming out next week? Anything good? I love January, don't you? We'll talk about it next week. Until then, the balcony is closed.